grief is a really big experience, and it felt clear that I wanted to say more than I could in a 1500 word essay. And so it pretty quickly took shape as a book, or as the goal was to turn it into a book. So I felt like the run was really reaffirming in bucking that temptation to live and run in a sheltered way, and really reaffirming in realizing that I was someone who wanted to live and run like my mom always had, in this courageous way. Doing this run had such a high possibility of failure. It felt like even if I had failed, I realized it was how I wanted to be existing in the world, that I wanted to be pursuing that kind of a thing, and that I wanted to be living and running from a more open, vulnerable place that did open me up to more possibility of disappointment and failure and devastation, but that also invited things like touching the Welcome to Washington sign on the Bridge of the Gods and realizing I could run across Oregon and have the most special, meaningful run of my life in doing that.
This episode of the Kintsugi Podcast is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, which can help you bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. Hey there, my fellow like-hearted humans. It's Michael, and this is the Kintsugi Podcast. This week, we have a gem of a story of connection, one of grieving, one of healing, one of breaking boundaries. So get ready to share. Share with people who love to run, those who prefer not to, those who love dogs, and even those who love cats. And you can also share with those you know who have lost a loved one, a parent, or maybe someone who hasn't yet. This story will touch your heart, will inspire you. This week, I'm joined by someone who's curious. She's a badass. She's gritty. She's resilient. She embodies our Kintsugi spirit. Like you, she's a like-hearted human. She's a certified badass. She's curious, she's a writer, she's a runner, she's gritty, she's resilient, she knows how to endure, and she's the type of person that you'd want to be friends with. Her first book, which we discuss in this week's conversation of connection, is called To the Gorge. And at first glance, you might think it's a book about running, but it's not. It's a book about how to live. It's about grieving the loss of her mom, her sister-in-law, and her dear dog, Brutus. It's about healing. It's about community. It's about doing hard things. It's about breaking new ground and setting new records. It's a book that made me laugh, made me cry, and made me think about how I want to live. Its author, and this week's story of connection, is with Emily Heldnon from Eugene, Oregon. And I can't wait to share her story with you. So get ready to share, because this is definitely one that you will want to share. So if you're ready, take a healthy breath in and a slow releasing breath out, and get to know Emily and her mom, and her run across Oregon. Hello, Emily. Good to see you.
Hello, Michael. It's great to see you. I'm glad we're doing this face-to-face, even if virtually.
Face-to-face. I'm so glad we have an opportunity to do this. So I want to start off here. How is your central nervous system doing today?
Oh, what a question on this day. Well, I am 2 weeks and a day, so 15 days out from the release of my book. And I would say that that has not been a thing that is great for my central nervous system. There's a lot of pre-publication anxiety and an endless list of to-dos. And I would say that my ability to nurture the state of my central nervous system has been a little compromised by those things.
I can appreciate that. I remember when I came out with my book, I was like, all right, we did it. It's going to be released. And then there was this anxiety of, will anyone read it? Like, you know, is it any good? You know, all that jazz. So I can totally appreciate it. And by the way, congratulations on writing the book. We're going to get deeper into To the Gorge as we go through our conversation. But I just want to say up front, to me, it was not a book. We're going to talk about running and your run to the gorge. But to me, it wasn't about running. It was about this human experience that we all share. You just did it through the vehicle of running. It's really a testament to how we can live, you know, with all the different feels, the periods of loneliness and the periods of togetherness and joy and sorrow and all of it. So excellent job. I'm so excited for what's to come for you and all your different readers that will be exposed to your work. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it, Michael. Yeah, I hope that on the other side of the publication of this book, I transition into a period where I'm connecting more with people, because that's why we write these things, these deeply vulnerable stories, and we want them to touch people and serve them in one of many different ways. And so I'm hopeful that in a few weeks, my central nervous system will feel much calmer and I'll be buoyed by hopefully having some meaningful conversations with people who read To the Gorge.
Yeah. I think they will be. You'll feel a whole bunch of other emotions too. So just, sure. You know, just to give you a bit of anticipation, no worry, but just anticipation that you're going to feel, as the kids would say, feel all the feels, you know. So how would you describe yourself? If we take your career off to the side, how you make money, how would you describe who you are?
Yeah. So that's a big question. I also appreciate, I know we both lived in DC for a while, and I don't know if you also feel like you developed an allergic reaction to the question, what do you do? But
that's why I asked the question the way I do, because I can't stand it. What do you do? I'd much rather have someone talk about how they wish to be or the things that shape them beyond our careers and what we do for money, because that period of time is not forever. It's short-lived. So I want to get to the things that really sort of light someone up. It can be their work, but I have post-traumatic stress disorder around that question, what do you do?
Yeah, one of my very least favorite questions in the world. I never ask it. I hate it. So I appreciate this question. It's a tough one, though, to try to succinctly capture who you are. I mean, kind of just some of the things that, some of the identities that I feel like I carry very closely. I'm a writer and a runner. And you just talked about how after my book comes out, I'll probably be feeling all the feels or whatever the kids say. I very much think of myself as someone who feels very deeply and who shares those feelings through both writing and running. I'm also a person who really values exploration, physical exploration, emotional exploration. I like to explore what I can do and push my limits. I'm someone who tries to prioritize fun and joy in life. I like to do a lot of hard things, but I also like to always make sure that joy is one of the North Stars that I'm orienting myself toward. I'm also Dilly's best friend, and I consider the love and friendship that we share to be one of the most meaningful forms of love in my life, Dilly being my rascal dog. Yeah, those are some of the things I think about as who Emily is.
That is so cool. I love those answers. And you have Dilly right near you right now as we talk. I have our puppy. I think I can still call her a puppy, Story, who is a Springer Spaniel.
How old is Story? I mean, I still call Dilly a puppy and he's 4, so.
Story is about now 16 months, 17 months.
Okay.
So I think I'm still, you know, I saw a photo of her. It came up in my memories thing, you know, on your phone when she was just a pup. I was like, oh my gosh, she was so little. She was so cute. She's cute in just a different way now as she's, yeah, you know, grown and gotten muscular and the whole thing like this. But for everyone listening out there, be forewarned, our dogs may bark at any moment in time. And that's just part of life. You know, it's a distraction. It's just their way of saying, hey, you know what? There's something out there that looks pretty exciting, you know, trying to grab our attention. So we'll probably keep it in if our dogs bark, because that's just the way we roll with life.
Just our life. Yep.
Cool. So can you bring us back to like where you grew up and just you know, we start getting into your relationship, of course, with your mom. And I obviously will dive deeper into this, but I'm so sorry for your loss. I also lost my mom during the pandemic. So as I read your story for different reasons than how your mom passed, but I was hoping you could bring us back to the beginning days, if you will. You can start wherever you want and how you formed a relationship with running. And then, of course, through that, we'll talk about your mom.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for your loss too.
Oh, thanks.
The maternal loss is a big one.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah, so To the Gorge is a story that's rooted in the loss of my mother, Andrea, who passed away from a rare uterine cancer in January 2020. She was 66 years old. And so I grew up in Vermont. I now live in Oregon. And a lot of the book is about how my mom shaped my relationship with running. And that all started when I was a teenager. My mom was an elementary school teacher for 42 years, I believe. She passed away the year after she retired. And for her entire life, that was part of her life, was being an elementary school teacher. And she was very much an elementary school teacher in and out of the classroom. We always did very like teacherly things throughout our summer, like went on tour, like had little scrapbooks full of thing, like our list of summer to-dos. And so my mom incorporated physical activity into our lives as one of those pillars of ways that she was making sure we had an enriching life. Like we lived in Vermont, we would go on hikes or go ride on the bike path, things like that. Like we were moderately active as a family, but she wasn't especially active. And she had a health scare when I was a teenager. She had to have her gallbladder removed. And that moved her to want to really change her relationship with physical activity, because that was part of the cause of her having this health scare. And so she decided to start getting a bit more physically active. And at first that looked like just short walks. Like we lived on around a wonderful web of dirt roads in a rural town in Vermont. And she would go walk a mile on the dirt road and then come home. And then I think because, and I'm sure we'll get into that this during our conversation, I think Howland women, Emily Howland, my mother's, Andrea Howland, I think that we are deeply competitive beings. And so her walking quickly morphed into organized race walking. She would go and do like race walk 5Ks and then 10Ks. And then she felt excited about the idea of trying to start running. So she started running and quickly was climbing the ladder of distances of what she could run, doing 5Ks, then 10Ks and half marathons. And then the year she turned 50, she ran her first full marathon. She ran the Vermont City Marathon, which is through the streets of Burlington, Vermont. And I feel like it might be impossible to watch your 50-year-old mother run a marathon, especially after knowing her as someone who very much did not have that relationship with the sport and not feel wildly inspired to run one yourself. And so after I watched her do that, I felt very motivated to try a marathon myself. And it wasn't immediate. It was about, I think, 3 years after she did her first marathon. She was on her fourth marathon, and it was my first one. And at the time, I still lived in Vermont, and we flew down to DC to do the Marine Corps Marathon, which I think was also your first marathon.
That was my first marathon. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah, we ran it together, or we didn't run it together. She beat me by 20 minutes in this marathon. I started like a total jerk and went out way too fast and then hit the wall around like mile 14. And, you know, the Marine Corps Marathon is so big. There's so many runners. There's like 30,000 runners or something. And so I had gone out really fast. And my mom, who was at this point, like kind of a seasoned marathoner, went out in a very smart, steady, responsible way. And around mile 14, I saw her just like cruising by I think she was with a pace group, and she just looked super strong, steady. And I started calling to her through the crowd, like a small child, like, "Mom, mommy." Like, I'm flooded with fatigue. I'm just like emotionally battered. Like, this is so hard. I don't know how I can keep going, calling for my mom. And she just couldn't hear me because there were a ton of runners around and crowds and stuff. And so I just watched her keep steadily cruising toward the finish line. And then I, you know, managed to keep going like you do when you are doing these things, and got to the finish and found her there. And that was the start of a very long and ongoing relationship with running for me. And it's special that it all started with my mom.
That's so cool. So I know, as you mentioned, I know that marathon really well. And so that's a classic tortoise and a hare story, right? Like
yes.
you're the jackrabbit. Your mom's just going to be, I'm going to turtle this. And for you to hit the wall at mile 14, for those that are not familiar, there's a section of this marathon that goes out to a part of DC called Haynes Point. I still believe that's the course that you ran.
I think so, yeah.
It's pretty lonely out there, even though you're surrounded by other runners, but it's...
Yes.
It's isolated. And so there's not a lot of spectators. So good for you to grit that out and then get across the bridge to the other side into Virginia. So I need to ask about your mom going from what I love about her story and her journey with fitness and running was small steps consistently over time. And she increased her distance and increased her distance. Did she also take on the vibe of a runner? Are you now like having conversations with your mom back then about how to fuel and goo and gels and all that stuff? Because there's one thing to see your parents in the way that we see them, but then they can take on a different persona, especially if they get into endurance sports. And it's like, it's a whole new vocabulary. So did you experience that with your mom?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm trying to think back on it. So obviously, she was getting into running for some years before I then got into running. But when you ask that question, more of what stands out to me is she did absolutely become a runner. And then as I became a runner, it was a shared language between us that, you know, we always had running, this connective tissue between us. And even when I proceeded to move away from Vermont and Washington, D.C. for 4 years and then moved across the country to Oregon, it was really special that we always had this thing that we could talk about in a way that not everyone can talk about. And that this thing that became so important to me was something that my mom understood on a deep, deep, deep level. Yeah. So that's, and I'm trying to remember like back before I got into it. She's someone who always went pretty deep into the things that she got into. She would get very excited and get very passionate about them. And so for sure, like I remember, you know, she immediately subscribed to Runner's World and.
Yes. All the signs. Yeah. All the signs. Like, a new obsession is starting. Like you start,
yeah.
New catalogs come into the house, you know, like in our household.
Yeah.
Everyone knows if dad's going to be on a new thread of something, the first thing to look out for is what kind of mail is dad now getting?
It's so funny.
What kind of boxes are coming into the house? Because
boxes for sure. Yeah.
That is a new hobby in formation. So,
yeah. And what's on display too? Like she would put like her race bibs. She, again, like very elementary school teacher. She scrapbooked everything. So I had a scrapbook of all of her race bibs. And she loved, like, she was always like winning age group ribbons and yes, those and like, you know, things on her refrigerator and framed photos. Like it quickly was something that was very important and special to her. And you could walk into our house and see that for sure.
That's so cool. So as your mom is going through her journey and battle with cancer, what comes out in your book is that your sister-in-law also gets diagnosed. And also your dog comes down with, would you categorize that as cancer as well for Brutus? So
that was my understanding, yeah.
Yeah, that's how it reads, but I wasn't particularly sure. All of a sudden, you're living life and mom's running and, you know, your brother-in-law and sister-in-law, you know, they're married and life seems pretty good. And then all of a sudden, people really close to you, you know, our animals, our, of course, our mom, sister-in-law all come down with illness. And I would love for you to share, like, how did that land for you? Because the people going through illness and what I went through and what I know others have gone through, obviously we're living it, but there's a ripple effect to that. You know, we talk sometimes about ripple effects being good, you know, we'll ripple gratitude or ripple kindness, but some of the challenge and the pain of going through something that can also ripple out. So I was curious, you know, how that landed on you and just, the question I had when I was reading it was like, why is this all happening? Like that was the question that was going through my head and I didn't know how you experienced it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was my question too. Basically, my sister-in-law was actually diagnosed first. It was in October 2018. I'm so bad at years and age, but she was a year older than I am and I'm 39 now. So I think she was 35 or 36 when she was diagnosed with breast cancer and it was 2 months after she married my brother. And, you know, they immediately started talking about children, bought this huge house. And you expect when you get married at 35 that your life will unfold in this way that makes sense, where you can be in love with your new husband and have all these babies. And, you know, she was surrounded by friends and family who loved her, and had, she owned a clothing boutique in Burlington that was beloved. And just like you said, life made a lot of sense and seemed great. And so that diagnosis obviously just sent an earthquake through Jess and Jameson's world, and by extension, everyone who loved them, including myself. And then less than 2 months later, about 2 months later, my mother was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive uterine cancer. And we just talked about how my mom got into running when she turned 50. And then we ran our first marathon together when she was probably 53 or 54. And she went on to, she learned how to swim when she turned 60, so she could do her first triathlon when she turned 60.
That's so cool.
She went skydiving to celebrate her birthday the year she turned 60.
Wow.
You know, she had retired a year early, and she thought it was so funny when she retired that people would ask her what she was going to do with all of her free time. She was like, I am going to have no trouble filling my free time. And she was a woman who just, like, joy was her North Star for sure. And she loved to ride her bike. She would go on like 70-mile bike rides around the covered bridges in Vermont. And then she would go to a bakery and get her favorite pastry and read. She read like 170 books her first year of retirement, which is a bonkers number of books to read. She traveled to Glacier National Park and ran a half marathon and went whitewater rafting. And she just was living and living in this just energetic, wholehearted, beautiful way. And then, and she was so, I mean, obviously she was so healthy, she was so fit, but she also was someone who was like so on top of her medical stuff. Like she, you know, got like mammograms, skin checks, like doing all, like checking all the boxes. And the very same day she experienced a symptom, she went to her doctor, and it was the type of cancer where it just, by the time it whispers a hint of its presence, it's kind of too late. And so it was already in its advanced stages. And so that happened about 2 months after Jessica was diagnosed. And yeah, I think the question was like, why is all of this happening? Like, you want the world to work in a way that makes sense. You want young, healthy, vibrant people, or I guess I think my mom is relatively young, but just you want healthy, vibrant people to be able to live these beautiful lives that they're living and that they deserve. And that's not the way that the universe works. And it's really hard to reckon with that when things like that are stacked on top of one another. And when they also passed away pretty closely to one another, my mom died 13 months after her diagnosis in January 2020. Jess's cancer spread, and she passed away in August 2020. And between those two deaths, my dog Brutus, my schnauzer, also passed away from an aggressive cancer. And I mean, I think about my brother, who was married to Jess, like, who had to bury his wife and his mother within 7 months. And it feels like that level of loss should not be legal, that you should not be allowed to live in a world that works that way. And so, yeah, I don't remember exactly how you phrased your first question, but I feel like through all of that, the question was like, why is all this happening? How can all of this be happening? This is too much.
Yeah, it just seems so unfair. And it's a painful lesson.
And senseless. I think it's like very, very senseless, very,
yeah,
it's hard to reckon with how all of that can correspond.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for all those losses that you experience. It is so hard to have them be stacked on top of each other, and to your brother too, as you mentioned. So just like, he's also going through it, but also quite differently than you, because he's married to Jess. I know part of your healing, so as we think about kintsugi and our pottery breaks, here we have, you know, three different situations where it can easily break the pottery that we have. And the reishi is the lacquer that brings the pottery pieces back together, and then we dust them with gold, and that becomes our golden symbols of strength. So running becomes, you know, in your story, running becomes a way to heal. So what inspired you? I know, like, you took off from your mom's inspiration and, you know, you became runner too. And then you were doing 100-mile runs and ultras and all that jazz. So what about running to the gorge inspired you? If you could give us a little bit of the backstory on this run, and then we'll get into the what the heck is a FKT. So love for you to share what that is for people who may not know what it is.
When my mom passed away, or I guess backing up, when my mom was sick, so we've covered a few stories about my mom that I hope share how bold and brave and what a wholehearted way she lived. And that really came through during the 13 months that she lived with cancer. Like, I had always been very in awe of my mom and always very inspired by the way that she lived, and she chased these big goals through sport. And then when she was diagnosed, she continued to live in this just like beautiful, like just stunning way. Like, I can't imagine what it's like to receive a life-threatening, life-ending diagnosis, to know, to see, like, we're all going to die, but to go from feeling like you're thriving in your retirement to all of a sudden needing to reckon with your own death, I think it would be really easy. And I totally understand how some people probably process that as a darkness that totally consumes them, and that darkness entombs their spirit, the way they live. And my mom, I think, you know, felt all the ways that having such a grim diagnosis was really hard and very dark, but she refused to let that be her life. And she insisted on continuing to live with a lot of joy and with a lot of courage and a lot of strength. And like one of my favorite, like she walked every day of chemotherapy and always had friends with her. It was one of the things that she really loved to do. But one of my favorite stories about the way that my mom lived with cancer was when she started chemotherapy, she started losing her hair, as often happens. And at first, it was something that gave her a lot of shame that she really didn't want people to see. It made her very uncomfortable. And then she was just like, I am sick of cancer having this like hold over me and my balding head. And like, I'm going to take this back from cancer. I'm going to be brave. And I'm going to like start to be bald. And similar to how she started running, it started in kind of a small way of like, I'm going to go to the gym and go to the treadmill and be bald there. And then she was just like, I am taking my head back from cancer. And she road tripped to, she lived in Vermont, and she got a few girlfriends to go with her and road tripped to this tiny little town in Maine that had a diner that had a Bald Thursday that offered you like 20% off your coffee and donuts and hash browns if you had a bald head. And there's a photo of my mom that like I could go to my refrigerator and get right now, where she's just cackling in this diner with just true joy all over her face. And it was incredible to see how she lived through that time, because meanwhile, like you said, there's this ripple. Like, I'm not the one who's sick, but I very much felt it affect my life in very profound ways. And I was having a lot of trouble continuing to like go through the motions of my days while my mom was doing this, and seeing that really affected me. And when she passed away, I decided that I wanted to do something in her kind of bold, brave, wholehearted spirit. And I decided that that thing would be to go after what is called the FKT, the fastest known time, on the 460-mile stretch of the Pacific Crest Trail that goes across the state of Oregon, so from the California border to the Washington border. So to try to run that 460 miles faster than any other human had. And part of what really, I think, moved me to do that was a recognition that while my mom was sick, I had let myself develop a kind of staleness, a kind of stagnant satisfaction with my running, that like I'd gotten into running because I liked that it was a way that I could push myself. I liked being able to use it to discover new layers of strength. And while my mom continued to do that in so many ways through both health and sickness, I recognized that I was not running and living like my mom always had. And so when she passed away, I felt really moved to correct that and to do it in a pretty big way. And so I decided to run across Oregon.
Wow, that is so, so cool. And thanks for sharing that story about Bald Thursday. So when I read that part of your story in your book, I was cracking up, but I was also like, this woman is like a badass, just leaning into all of life. That is a thread as you share your story about your mom, just like, we're going to live fully.
Yes.
And I don't think you said it in any specific way, but almost an appreciation of life can be really painfully short. And so while we're here, we're going to live life fully and boldly, yeah, and courageously. And we're going to take back some of our control, right? So there's a notion out there like, well, we're not in control. And I understand why people say that. I do think we have maybe more control than we realize in terms of like how we want to show up when we face adversity, when we face challenges.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that like what I realized watching how my mom lived with cancer was that we're not in control of how many days that we have, but we are in control of what we do with our days. And
absolutely, yeah.
And I think that that is something that I I really embraced from watching how my mom lived through the thing that she had no control over and would have done anything to kick out of her life.
Absolutely. So you come up with this aha, we're going to run across Oregon and we're going to do it faster than anyone else ever. What was the reaction from those closest to you, your friends, maybe your brother? Because it's really bold. Like, you're going to do what? And they know you're a runner and they know you can do ultras, but what was their reaction like?
That's a great question. I'm trying to go back in time. I mean, I had so much support and excitement surrounding me from people in my life when I started this run. And I think when I started talking about it, you know, it's funny looking back at when I made that decision. While I can look back and appreciate why I did it, I think there's a few different reasons that I did it. At the time, I feel like it wasn't even a decision. It just was obvious. Like, I'm going to do, this is what makes sense in this like hugely disruptive earth rupturing time where I'm just squashed by this immense grief of losing my mom. Like, this is what makes sense to me. And I think that it probably felt that way to those who are closest to me, to my partner, Ian, to my brother, to some of my best running friends, that it was like, of course, this is what you would do to honor and celebrate your mom. Like, no one was like, should you do that? Can you do that? I think there was much more immediate support and recognition that it was a move that would probably serve me in many ways as I was wading through this really difficult time in life.
Yeah, the strength of community, the strength of your Peloton, you know, to say, yeah, that's exactly what you're going to do to honor your mom. So as you start the first day, you make the first day a pretty long day. And that second morning, can you bring us into that second day, the start? Because you've done a lot already. And the sense I got was like, there was a lot of pain, you know, like you were tired and it was almost like, what am I doing? Like, this is going to be really tough. So how did you get through that moment, that period of difficulty?
I think, and are you thinking that the second day was my longest day on the trail? It was like the 72-mile day. The second day. So yeah, so basically to get through Southern Oregon at record pace, so you can choose how to do these FKTs, these fastest known times. And I did it in a supported style, which meant that I could have people crewing me and pacing me along the way. And so I had like my partner, Ian, and my dog Dilly, who at the time was a 5-month-old puppy, were driving around in this old van and had, you know, lots of food and a mattress pad for me to sleep on and stuff. And so in order to get through Southern Oregon and the time that you need, you have to do a 72 mile day on one of the first 2 days. And I decided to do it on the second day. And so the first day, I think I did about 60 or 62 miles. And then the second day I did 72 miles. And while I had run 100 miles before, the stacking of those days and doing 72 miles after I'd already done 62 miles and had, you know, the math is difficult right now, but it's like still over 300 miles at the end of that 72 day. So that 72 mile day really got in my head because it was just like from the first step of the day, I was crushed by the overwhelm of it. Cause at, you know, first step of the day, I've got 72 miles.
It's so big.
Yeah. And then anytime I looked at my watch, I was just like, it's so big. Like,
yeah, it's just like mentally screwing with your mind. You just did like 60 plus miles, which, you know, the marathon is 26. So you did like 2+ marathons day one.
Yeah.
And now you're going to have to do almost like 3 marathons the second day.
Yeah.
And once you're done, you still got about 300 more miles to go. It was like, holy cow, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. So the record for the run was held by this great athlete, Brian Donnelly, and he did it in 7 days and 22 or 23 hours. I don't remember his exact time, but so I knew I had to do this in less than 8 days, which meant averaging about 60 miles a day. And so that was the kind of math I was working with. But yeah, it was so, anytime I looked at my watch, it just would shout back at me, like, you have 1,000,000 miles left. Like when I had done 30 miles, like a 50K, I still had 40 miles to go. And I wasn't fresh. I had 60 miles in my legs from the day before. So that entire day really felt overwhelming. It got hard to take the next step for a lot of that day because it was just crushing to even like when I got towards the end of the day and had 2 miles left, I was like, 2 miles.
2 miles. And you're in the dark too. Like
I was very much in the dark at that point. Yeah.
You're finishing in the dark. It's just really rough.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about Danielle? Because Danielle was, you know, such a Sherpa to you, you know, helping you get through this I'm not sure how good of a singer she is, but she was definitely singing. You know, let's say Danielle was an awesome singer, like pitch perfect. So
she's great.
Yeah. So can you share a little bit more about how Danielle supported you through this whole journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So Danielle had established a women's record on the stretch of trail the year before. And I didn't know her at the time, but when I saw that, it was a very encouraging thing because especially as a woman, you know, sometimes we're told we're not capable of doing certain things, and to see other women do them is a very empowering thing. And so when I saw Danielle do this, I felt very encouraged by the fact that she had done it, and she did it with the intent of inviting other women to step out and do this kind of thing. And she was like, I hope the next woman like gives me a call when she decides to do it. And so when I decided to go after the record, I did that. I like slipped into her DMs on Instagram and let her know that I wanted to do the run, that I had a lot of respect and admiration for her effort on the trail, and let her know kind of my reasons behind it about my mom. And she immediately, like seconds later, responded with a lot of enthusiasm and with an offer to support me in my attempt. And we ended up going for a run shortly after that and became very, very fast friends. And she quickly became a great source of friendship and support, not just for the run, but through the grief that I was working through at the time. And I think that the way that she showed up for me on that second day that I talk about in the book of, so she's with me, she was with me for probably 30 to 40 miles of that day. And she was with me through some of my just absolute most miserable. I'm like, I just want, like, she's like, how are you doing? And I'm like, I want the trail to become an escalator. Like, I'm mad at Mother Nature for not doing that. And I was just this toddler on the trail. And she just didn't falter at all from supporting me and sticking with me as I worked through the misery of that day. And that's the same thing that she did through grief, where like, especially when we want to support someone who's going through something like the death of one of their closest loved ones, we can feel so helpless in how to support them because we can't do the one thing that they really need. We can't bring that person back to them. But there's so much power in the people who are willing to just stick by our side while we wade through our hardest times and our lowest lows and our deepest grief. Someone who can like not turn away from those hard emotions and who can watch you feel your rawest grief and say like, it's okay, I'm not going anywhere. Like you can feel what you need to feel right now. And I'm just going to stay here by you. And we don't have to feel alone in those moments because we have someone who's willing to do that. And I feel like Danielle in both running and grief is that person for me who's like, she's not going to move an inch away from my side. She's going to be there with me no matter how abysmally low I get. And there's just so much power in that kind of support, but in both running and especially in grief and life.
I got goosebumps as you were sharing that because it's so true. Like just sitting in the mud with us, just sitting in it, and they don't even have to say anything.
No.
You know, because a lot of times we just don't know what to say, you know, and sometimes it's like, you don't need to say anything. Just be here. Like it's the energy of them around us to say, okay, we're going to get through this. This is a really hard thing. You can do hard things. We'll do hard things together. And you can feel the hand on your back from those types of people that are willing to like sit in the mud.
Because it's not easy to sit in the mud. It's not comfortable to sit in the mud.
No, who wants to sit in the mud? Like
no one wants to. It's not good.
You know, 97% of us want to serve and support and help in some form or fashion. And to your point, Emily, like the thing, you know, the first thing to help is like bring mom back or, you know, bring Brutus back or bring Jess back, but we can't bring them back. And so then we're like, okay, what do I do now to help? I don't know what to do. And what I experienced is like a lot of the folks that didn't know what to do or what to say just didn't show up. And at first I was really pissed at them for not showing up, but then I realized they just didn't know how to show up because it was so uncomfortable and they weren't ready to sit in the mud, you know, because it's messy and the mud is stinky. We want to get out of it, but that's exactly what we need in some of those moments is someone to be there in the mud with us and not trying to fix it or make it better right away because they know we just have to like run through the mud, slog through the mud.
Yeah. And that slogging through the mud is infinitely I don't know if easier or better is the right word, but to not have to do it alone means everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Slogging through the mud alone is even less fun than sitting in the mud.
Yeah, that sucks no matter.
And having someone who's willing to slog through the mud with you is, it's like, yeah, there's nothing they can do to give you what you really want in that moment, but it means everything to have them willing to stay by your side through that.
Yeah, I know. Danielle, the way you write about her, you know, I think the reader is going to gain, like, she is one special, like-hearted human, as we like to say here on the Kintsugi podcast.
She is. I want everyone to have a Danielle. She's a special person.
Oh, yeah. Like, everyone in the world should have a Danielle in their lives. Like, just, like, that should just be part of the package when we're born. Everyone gets a Danielle.
Yes.
So I want to fast forward in your run a bit, because you had a moment where a lot of your running friends from Eugene joined you. So on this theme of community, right? So you also had a lot of those friends join you as well on the trail. And I didn't know if you could share a little bit about what that meant to you.
Yeah. Like I said, I received a lot of very eager and generous support through this run. And I've joked that, like, I need another category of FKT of, like, the extra supported style of run, because I felt very spoiled by support. And I think I have found in running, so I've done a bunch of 100 milers at this point, maybe 7 or 8 100 milers. And you can also be paced and crewed in 100 milers, which means you can have people show up to support you at designated aid stations along the 100 mile course. And whenever I've had people support me, they're always, they get a little stressed. Like, what do you need to, like, what's our job? Like, you know, and thinking that I'm going to give them this, like, extensive rundown of, like, you need to put 7.5 ounces of this sport drink powder in this flask and, like, give me 117 calories of this other thing and don't screw it up. But I always tell them, I'm like, the thing I'm going to get most out of you is just seeing you, is just coming into an aid station, seeing you, high-fiving you, hugging you, like, maybe dancing for a few minutes or a few seconds with you. And it's almost creepy how much time I spend thinking about my friends when I'm doing these big runs, because it's like they're the thing reeling me in of, like, oh, I get to see my people, and I get such a boost from it. And so that was absolutely true during my run across Oregon, is that I had people show up in so many different ways, whether it was, like, in very practical support at designated spots on the trail, or just I had people show up and surprise me with what's called trail magic, where you don't know that this is a big thing in the thru hiker world, where maybe they get to a trail intersection and there's someone sitting there with a cooler with, like, popsicles and watermelon, or someone who gives them a ride into town, or, like, something that really helps them out on the trail. And I had a couple of friends hike several miles in and surprise me with trail magic, and they had brought Dairy Queen and their dog Fitz, and they were all dressed up. My friend Gretchen was wearing this, like, fuchsia prom dress straight from, like, 1987. And Eric, her husband, who does not normally dress up for anything, was wearing some, like, bright floral stuff. And they had brought a Powerade that they had the brilliance to freeze the night before so that it would still be cold when they hiked it several miles up the PCT. And this was in August in Oregon. So it was very, very hot, and getting this, like, glacially ice cold beverage was just one of the greatest gifts that I have ever had. And that full day that they surprised me, that was my fourth day on the trail. It was when I hit my halfway point. It was when I think hit the 200 mile mark, which came before the halfway point. And that day was the day that the PCT was closest to Eugene, which is where I live in Oregon. And I have a running group here that I've been running with since, I think, the second week I lived in this state. And they're some of my closest and best friends, both in running and outside of running. And they all showed up from start to finish on that day to support me. And we run on Tuesdays. I think Tuesdays are a very sacred day of the week for all of us. And we've been running on Tuesdays since I moved here. And I, like, planned my run so I could be on this trail around a Tuesday. And they kind of treated it like it was our regular run. And I stopped on a lake that night, and they had brought, like, grills and coolers and tents. And it was this very large display of support and good food. And I was just, from start to finish, was spoiled by support from this group. And I like to tell the story of, like, my first year that I lived in Oregon, I moved houses in town, and I asked this group, and, you know, it's so hard to ask for help. It's, like, so hard to ask for help. And I got all, like, oh, I don't know if I should ask people to help me move. And I finally worked up the courage to ask this group to help me. And I think every single person showed up with trucks and vans and Honda elements. And I think my move took 17 minutes to get from one house to another because they showed up in a big way. And this day on the PCT felt like that all over again, of just they all showed up and ready to like help me get that thing done. And they did.
That is so cool. Well, it goes to the power of community in helping us get through hard things, helping us heal, you know, in the spirit of like, together we go far, right? So now I have to ask, did anyone bring you Tillamook dairy, Tillamook ice cream at all?
No Tillamook ice cream, but I bet that there was Tillamook cheese.
Oh, yes.
In the, because my friend Evan was grilling stuff, and it would be weird if it wasn't Tillamook cheese. So I'm pretty sure that would have been, yeah.
That is good. When I did my ride across America, one of our first stops was at the Tillamook dairy.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And here's the thing. My wife grew up in Portland, or outside of Portland. And so Tillamook was a thing, right? So where I grew up in the East Coast, I knew nothing of Tillamook. But then I, you know, met her, we'd go to Portland and we'd hear about Tillamook and Tillamook Dairy and field trips to the Tillamook Dairy. And we would bring back bricks of Tillamook cheese. It looked like kilos of cocaine or whatever, or drugs.
Yeah, it's
like
a, yeah. I'm familiar with bricks of Tillamook. Yeah.
It's like these bricks that we'd go through TSA with, and people are like, what are you bringing back? And it's like cheese, but we'd have like 20 pounds of cheese. It's like,
oh, yeah.
It was crazy, like especially when our girls were younger. So on my way down to Eugene on my ride, we had to stop at the Tillamook Dairy and get a good old fashioned milkshake, because I had a milkshake every day on my ride. Yeah, that was my big thing.
Did you say every day?
Every day. Although here's the controversy. You can weigh in on this, Emily. We digressed a little bit.
No, this is great. I like talking about snacks and endurance sports.
So one night we couldn't find a dairy where we were. So I got a DQ Blizzard. So I would do a milkshake every day. That was my little treat. I started in Astoria the night before the ride with a Marion Berry milkshake.
Very Oregon.
So Oregon. Like it was out of Central Casting. I'm there in Astoria, a Marion Berry milkshake, whatever else with dinner, but the shake was delicious. So we're like 5 days in. There's no dairy in town, except there is a DQ. So I get a Blizzard. And I'm like, well, today's milkshake is, you know, a Reese's Pieces Blizzard. And you would have thought I started like the biggest controversy in the world. People came out of the woodwork saying that a Blizzard is not a milkshake. And since I had this little thing going, this streak of like, you know, 4 or 5 days, I was like, no, it is a milkshake. And people called the DQ headquarters.
Wow.
Yeah. People got a little crazy, all out of love, of course. So before I give you the answer to the controversy, how do you weigh in on a Blizzard? Is a Blizzard a milkshake or not?
I mean, no, it's definitely not a milkshake.
Yeah, okay, all right. Yes.
but I also think that you get to define your rules and interpret them as you want to when it's a rule like, I'm going to have a milkshake every day. And especially for like a cross-country ride, I would imagine that there's got to be some spots where you would have to get a little creative with what that means and looks like. And I would count. I think the intent is there, and I would count that.
Everyone can be right. So technically, a Blizzard is not a milkshake because of the milk fat content in a Blizzard versus a real milkshake. That's the technical ice cream engineering.
Okay.
But yeah, so we had to be a little creative. We were in a RV, so we had stored up on Tillamook ice cream. So I had in the freezer of the RV, I had a whole bunch of Tillamook ice cream. And so when we got to a town where they didn't have a dairy, which is a shame, I do believe this is my platform if I ever run for political office. Wi-Fi for the whole country, and every town should have an ice cream dairy.
Wow.
For everyone out there who's not into dairy or lactose intolerant, I'm probably not going to get their vote, but you know, that's okay. We only need 51%.
He would get Dilly's vote. He's a big milkshake fan.
Yeah.
He would support that.
Yes. I'm going to carry the dog vote.
Yes, definitely.
All right. So you get to the end and you get to the finish. Bring me into that moment. What was going through your mind, through your body, as you're about to finish your big run?
As the kids would say, I was feeling all the feels. For sure.
Yeah.
Flooded with feelings. Yeah. So I set the record. I ran it in 7 days and 19 hours and 22 or 23 minutes. And that did not seem like a guarantee to me until somewhere in that last day on the trail. And so it was overwhelming in the best, most satisfying, most joyful way to actually be doing this thing that I wanted to do for my mom, that I had spent months building up for. I had spent days of like I wanted, the whole point of this run was to do the hardest run of my life. And like, boy, did I get that. I went through some stuff on the trail and it did not feel certain that I would get to the bridge. I knew I was going to do everything in my power to get there. But until that last day, it really did not seem certain that I was going to, especially to set the overall record, to beat the men's mark as well as the women's mark. And so that was incredible. Also, I thought about my mom so much through the whole run. I think especially on that last day, my mom and I were extraordinarily close and she was my first call through everything, good or bad or terrible or wonderful. And to be doing this huge thing, to be finishing it, to be getting steps closer to realizing this huge goal that I had set for myself and that I was doing for her. Like all I wanted to do with every fiber of my being was call her and tell her about it. And I was feeling a lot of grief and a lot of longing for my mom that day. And I was also, you know, I think a special thing about having something like running with my mom is that it's very easy to imagine how she would respond to things. And I thought a lot about what she would be thinking and what she would be feeling, what she would say, how excited she would be, how proud she would be, how many times she would have posted on Facebook. It would have been.
That's such a wonderful mom thing to do. Yeah, just your biggest cheerleader. And so while you were finishing, I'm assuming you could hear her voice like encouraging you on, because we all have a little voice and a little narrative in our head. Sometimes it's a self-narrative, but sometimes it comes from outside of us. Was she right there sort of whispering in your ear like, hey, Emily, you can do it. You can do it. You're strong.
I think so. Yeah. And like you said, my mom was my greatest cheerleader and I felt that day. And I think I also, it wasn't just that I could hear her. I felt like I could see her. My mom had this very like kind of soft, quiet, but like very proud, excited smile. And I, you know, that's like, that was in the most frontal lobe of my brain that day, I think. And I feel like I held her close in a lot of ways that day.
Yeah, that's so special. That's so special. So what did you discover most about yourself doing this? Because you went through one total badass for accomplishing what you accomplished. Just, you know, taking on the challenge, that's a win. Finishing the challenge, that's a win. But then doing it with the fastest known time, what an incredible, like, again, badass thing to do, Emily. So I'm like so pumped for you. I was like rooting you on. I was just reading the book. But when we go through these big challenges, I do believe for many people, you know, the two of us included, is that we push our bodies because we're pushing our bodies and minds into the fullest of our potential. Like we're gonna learn something about ourselves through pushing our bodies and minds and soul and energy and all that jazz outside its comfort zone. So I'm curious, what did you discover about yourself?
I mean, I think a lot. I think there were a lot of things that emerged through the run. I think one thing that stands out to me is that, and I can also go back and touch more on kind of the physical and mental side of what I think I gained from pushing myself and from really like emptying myself out on this trail. But one thing that stood out is that the run felt very reaffirming to me. You know, when we talked about like getting hit with this succession of devastation in life, of like first all these people getting diagnosed with life-threatening illness and then losing so many loved ones, my mom, my sister-in-law, my dog. I think it's very easy and very tempting to respond to things like that by trying to shelter yourself from more pain, from more disappointment, from more heartbreak and grief. It's not fun to go through that kind of put your heart in a blender and beat it to pulpy innards kind of loss. And I think the run to me felt like I was trying to live in this way, to run and live in this way that my mom always had by being bold and brave and embracing the vulnerability that goes with that. And I don't mean to compare running to life and death, but I think deciding to go after this run that felt like a very vulnerable thing and felt like very uncertain and felt like it was possible that you're going to have to take this out. My UPS just showed up and they have my phone that I think I have to sign for. And
okay. Well, hit pause. This is real life. Well, go get your phone. Yeah.
Okay, great. This will take me like 1 second, but hold on.
And then come back. Yeah, this is awesome. Yeah. As Emily goes to the door to find out what UPS has delivered to her, let's take a moment to pause, breathe, reflect. And we'll come back and talk about more of Emily's story. All right. Let's take a break. Take a full breath in and a slow releasing breath out. And relax the body as you soak up our conversation. Ah, I hope that felt good. Okay, now that we're a little bit more relaxed, can we be real? I think our morning routines, well, they've gotten a little out of control. You might not have time in the morning to meditate because you're busy doing other things like trying to get to work or getting the kids off to school. And this is where my app, Pause, Breathe, Reflect, comes in, because I built it for busy people with a whole bunch of shorter practices. So if you don't have 10 minutes in the morning to meditate, cool beans. You're human after all. But I bet you have 5 times throughout the day when you have 2 minutes to practice and let go of stress and bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. So today, download Pause, Breathe, Reflect for free and begin to stress less, sleep better, and join a community of like-hearted humans rippling something worth rippling into the world. All right, let's go back to our conversation and celebrate the kintsugi within us all. So now you got your new phone.
I haven't been an iPhone person, and I'm like, finally.
Oh, you've made the switch.
I'm making the switch. I've grown too tired of, my technology not being compatible with anyone else's. Anyway, so I felt like the run was really reaffirming in bucking that temptation to live and run in a sheltered way, and really reaffirming in realizing that I was someone who wanted to live and run like my mom always had, in this courageous way that embrace the vulnerability that goes with that, and that, like, recognizing that to live this more sheltered, more comfortable existence meant, like, maybe you're protecting yourself from some disappointment, but also, like we've talked about, there's only so much that you can even control. You're still going to deal with crap, but that you're also depriving yourself from realizing the other side of the spectrum, that you're, to try and protect yourself from the valleys, you're protecting yourself, depriving yourself of the peaks. And I think doing this run had such a high possibility of failure. It felt like even if I had failed, I realized it was how I wanted to be existing in the world, that I wanted to be pursuing that kind of a thing, and that I wanted to be this, to be living and running with a more open, from a more open, vulnerable place that did open me up to more possibility of disappointment and failure and devastation, but that also invited things like touching the Welcome to Washington sign on the Bridge of the Gods and realizing I could run across Oregon and have the most special, meaningful run of my life in doing that. And so that was one thing that definitely stood out.
I love that. I know for me, like before my accident, I was terrified of dying. Like I wouldn't want to talk about it.
Even before your accident?
Before my accident, I did not want to talk about dying. Like, it's what happens to other people, like that type of thing, which a lot of people have that sensibility. Like, we don't love to talk about the inevitable, especially in the West. That's all I can relate to. That's my experience. But after my accident and when I got so close to dying, it changed my relationship with it. So to your point, whether it's equating running to life or cycling to life, but it's more about, I'm going to live. I was playing it safe. And what you shared is like so spot on. We try to prevent the valleys, but when we do that, we deny ourselves the great heights, the joy of reaching the pinnacle. And for me, I was like, I just want to live. I want to experience it all. And yeah, I'm going to trip and fall. I'm going to break again like Kintsugi, but I can find a way to come back together and celebrate the symbols of my strength and like fully live. Because one thing for certain, I just don't know how long I'll be here for. So I don't want to live a life where I'm playing it safe. I want to try to live fully. And so, you know, reading your book, I totally saw that in your mom, and I also see it in your journey through this. So I think you've probably had, you know, people close to you say this, but the qualities I saw in your mom as I read through your book, like I see those in you.
It's the greatest compliment that I can get.
Yeah, you know, it's like she's right there with you. Like to know you is to know your mom. It's such a powerful story. And as I mentioned up front, it's not a running story. You tell it through running, but it's a it's a community story. It's how to heal story. It's a tenacity story. It's about living wide awake. And we've already mentioned it a few times here, but we're going to experience all the feelings. And that's a really wonderful way to live once we have the courage to actually live that way.
Yeah, it's full of feelings, that's for sure.
Yeah. So what inspired you to write a book? Because this is your first book, right?
It is.
You get through with the run. It's like, okay, the next day, no running. I'm not sure if you went for a run, but what was that conversation that you were having with yourself around, now I want to write a book about it?
Yeah. So this is my first book. I'd done a little bit of, I've always been a writer, but I'd done a little bit of published writing before starting to work on this book. And the thread between all of the writing that I had done before, which was pretty much all essay length, like 1500 word pieces, was using running or the outdoors or outdoor adventure to explore different elements of the human experience. And so I think when I like go through this, one of the most profound experiences that I've had as a human of the grief of losing my mom alongside all of the other loss that was wrapped up into that time, it felt obvious I was going to write about it. And then as I had done this 8-day run to celebrate my mom and to process this grief of losing her, it was also very obvious that I would use that particular run to write about grief. And I think as soon as I started thinking about doing that and started putting words on a page, it was also pretty obvious that it was probably a book length project. Grief is a really big experience, and it felt clear that I wanted to say more than I could in a 1500 word essay. And so it pretty quickly took shape as a book, or as the goal was to turn it into a book.
Beautiful. I love it. So a few questions before we wrap up. What did you eat? Like get into some brass tacks. Like,
let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what does one eat to power their way through a run like that?
Yeah. I had more trouble eating than I normally do. I feel like that's normally one of my superpowers as an endurance athlete, is I'm really good at eating while going on these long distance runs. But I don't know if it was like the heat, a little bit of elevation. It was a little bit harder than I wanted it to be to eat. But I'm a big proponent of real food during these things. So I ate a lot of real food, whether that was snacky things like chips and candy. I basically, like, you could go into a gas station and find a lot of the things that I would eat on a run. You know, I also eat like a lot of pastries, and my friend's mom made me carrot cake, and I had a couple of very good burritos. The Dairy Queen, honestly, that my friends brought to the trail was one of the things that tasted the best of all the things that I ate on the trail, like French fries. They brought me a hot dog. That was great too. A Rice Krispie treat. What I think, like, when you're doing a run like that, whatever seems appetizing is, I mean, you have to force yourself to eat stuff, but then also, like, if something seems appetizing, it's just like shovel that in and get it while you can. So all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, my trip was fueled by sour cream and cheddar Ruffles potato chips.
Oh, yeah.
Like, give me convenience food store food. Like, I'm all about it. So I have a 350-mile gravel race coming up at the end of May.
About how long does a 350-mile gravel, it's like a multi-day thing?
The cutoff is 35 hours. So my hope is I can do it in 30, you know, give or take.
Okay, yeah.
But I know all the mile markers to all the convenience stores, all the Casey's in Northeast Kansas. So we're going to hit up them. Hopefully they have ordered plenty of cheddar cheese Ruffle potato chips, because I will be consuming a bag or two. So yeah, so I'm right there with you. Like, whatever feels good, tastes good. You know, we go in thinking, oh, this is exactly what we're going to eat. And then sometimes those frozen M&Ms are like just the thing that we need. And like, gone are all these absolutes about, oh yes, I'm a, you know, whole foods, plant-based person. I'm just like, give me food. I need calories.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how can people find out more about you? Of course, the book's out. We will put the link to Amazon and other places to buy the book. But if they wanted to find out a little bit more about your story and connect with you, how would someone do that?
I'm probably most readily available on Instagram. I'm at Emily Sweats, like perspiration. And technically, I have a website, emilyhowland.com. And I have a newsletter that I don't write all that frequently called Trail Mix on Substack. And then, yeah, my book, To the Gorge, is a great place to learn about that part of my story.
Yes, buy Emily's book, folks. Like, it's a great read. Again, if you're a runner, it's a great read. If you're not a runner, it's a great read because it's about being human. And it's a beautiful human read. So, Emily, you completely embody the Kintsugi spirit.
Thank you.
I'm so glad. I'm not sure how I came across your Instagram feed.
I was wondering, because you reached out a while ago before there was even a lot out about it.
Yeah, so I'm not sure exactly how I did it, but all of a sudden you popped into my feed. I'm like, okay, who's this chick? Like, what's her deal? And I was like, oh, wow, she's like pretty badass. And then, you know, there was an Oregon connection and there's a little bit of Vermont connection. And then I pulled the thread further. Of course, you've already mentioned our DC connection. We almost moved to Vermont way back when.
Oh.
From DC, we almost moved to Burlington. So I was like, okay, there are some geographic similarities between Emily and me. And then once I read more about your endurance athlete chops, I was like, all right, this is a good Kintsugi story. So you do embody it. Like, you know, knowing that you've gone through some hard challenges in life and some, you know, some loss and some grief. And what I heard from you is just the power of community, the power of being courageous and bold and living life fully. And that's some of the glue that brings our pottery back together, the resilience, your grit, your perseverance. And so we need more stories like this in the world because, you know, we're all going through something every now and again. And we need stories like yours to remind ourselves that we're strong and together we can go far. So thanks for writing your book and sharing your story.
Thanks for reading it and listening to my story and sharing it with your community. It's been great to connect and I appreciate the different threads that we share and have very much appreciated this opportunity to talk about everything that you just went through.
Awesome, Emily. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I love Emily's energy and I hope you did as well. And I hope you'll pick up a copy of To the Gorge. I'll put the link in the show notes. Of course, you can go to Amazon or wherever you buy your books. There's a really good bookstore north of her in Portland, Oregon, called Pals. I highly recommend it. You can order from them online, one of the best independent bookstores in this country. I'm sure you took away some beautiful pearls from Emily's story, and I would love to know what resonated with you. So reach out in any way that you can. And I want to take a moment here to thank you for carving out some time. I know it's your most precious resource. So it means a lot that you've joined us here on the Kintsugi podcast. And if you haven't already, I would love if you left a kind review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And I hope you'll join our wonderful, like-hearted community here at Pause, Breathe, Reflect for some mindfulness and coaching. There's nothing quite like it out there. If you're already a member, thank you. If you still need to become a member, now is a really good time because you can pay whatever you can for your first year. And if you'd like to receive my weekly newsletter called The Ripple Effect, because it's all about the ripple we put into the world, head to michaelobryanshift.com and you can sign up for the weekly newsletter. Again, thank you for being here. Thank you for the connection. And remember, between now and the next time we celebrate our golden symbols of strength here on Kintsugi, if you meet a challenging moment, slow it down. Come back to your breath. And know that you've got this, and we've got you. And together, we'll put a beautiful ripple into the world.